Committee will please come to order. Committee, our next presentation is from Dr. Dave Hill from the INL. And we look forward to your presentation. It's a pleasure to have you here today. And please introduce yourself for the record, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dave Hill. I'm the Deputy Director for Science and Technology at Idaho National Lab. Need to be a little closer to... Okay. Again, I'll start again then, if that wasn't loud enough. My name is Dave Hill. I'm the Deputy Director for Science and Technology at Idaho National Lab. I'm here representing the lab director, Admiral Grossenbach, who unfortunately couldn't be here today. I appreciate your hospitality and look forward to this. I'm going to talk about what we expect over the next year at Idaho National Lab, and I've also spoken to two other contractors who have operations on our site and got some basic data from them to make sure everybody understands. The physical Idaho National Lab, we are the lab contract, INL, and there are two other contracts, the Idaho Cleanup Project and the Advanced Mixed Waste Treatment Plant. I have data for all three of those. I'll give you the bottom line right now. Fiscal year 2009, we expect largely to be like fiscal year 2008. So the basic assumption is the same as last year. And the fiscal year is the government fiscal year, which operates from October the 1st to September the 30th. So to be clear on those, when I mention a year, it'll be October to October. So just a few words about some of the things that happened in 2008, which I think are worthy of note. As we were just talking here up to the side, the big event was the announcement by Areva that they were going to site an enrichment plant actually right next to our site, out on US 20 and abuts our site. They've already submitted their application. It will be several thousand construction jobs, 2,000 I think, and when fully operating, something like 500 or 600 full-time jobs. Very big deal. The state, the local Partnership for Science and Technology and ourselves all contributed to help do that, and it's very important for Southeast Idaho. We opened the Center for Advanced Energy Studies, which is both a building and a program. Again, the state contributed to that through settlement funds. We, the contractor, guaranteed bonds, and the state contributed some land. I believe it turned out to be about a $17 million building, and I'll have more detail on how we're doing in a later view graph. The various waste agreements, so this is very important for work at the Idaho National Lab. The settlement between DOE and the state has lifted a cloud and enabled us to have a much more positive relationship with DOE. It didn't in itself stop work, but there was a general, why should I invest in Idaho when we have this conflict going on? That agreement has made a huge difference to us. The Idaho Regional Optical Network, and something you may be less familiar with, this is a not-for-profit consortium of the Idaho State, three Idaho universities, the Hospitals Association, the State of Idaho itself, Washington State, BYU Idaho, and ourselves to connect us up to what is effectively the interstate system for computers. Huge data pipeline, and no state or entity that is going to be entering into the modern era can afford not to be connected. So again, the state played an important role there, and we are now connected to that. And more parochially, our contract is a 10-year contract, but it had a 3-year off-ramp. And DOE conducted an assessment and agreed to let us keep this contract till 2014 with a potential extension to 2019. Apart from making us feel good, the significance of that is stability, long-term stability. The same contract, so we can plan now for many years and not have to worry about competing, make investments for the long term. And one of the investments we're doing is in revitalizing the campus. If you haven't been over to Idaho Falls lately, our in-town facilities are mostly on University Place there on the north side of it. Private contractors have built buildings to the north of us adjacent to the Kays facility and are leasing them to us. We're occupying three new buildings there. And out on our site, we have three or four, I don't actually remember, new buildings under construction to upgrade the facilities, provide better working conditions for our staff. So it's part of a long-term investment after years of neglect out there to improving Idaho National Lab and making it a world-class lab for the future. So all of that has gone on in 2008. So when we look at 2009, and as I said, our fiscal year began in October, but it still has to be a future look because we're under continuing resolution. Federal government, as it often does, or nearly always does nowadays, passed continuing resolution budget on October the 1st with certain spending rules which limit our abilities to spend money in general to the way it was spent in 2008. There are variations of that, but that really is the essence of it. And any time there's a presidential election, it introduces uncertainty as well. In this case, with the change in the flavor of administration, there's extra uncertainty. I have no special insights. Newspapers tell me to expect that Congress will pass a 2009 budget shortly, but we don't know that for a fact, so we're still operating under 2008 funding. On the other hand, we do know already that the incoming administration is very much focused on job creation, for the obvious reason of the economic problems the country is facing. And the questions that we are getting via the Department of Energy is, how can we create more jobs? So when you balance all of that out, our best estimate and our operating parameters for 2009, you know, that we will be the same budget and the same workforce as 2008. So let me just talk a little about what 2008 looked like then, because this is roughly how we see 2009 playing out. The graph on the top right shows how the budget has grown for the lab since we took over in the middle of 2005. And in 2008, we closed the books at $799 million. And that's $799 million spent. That's business volume. 8% year-on-year growth, nearly 50% since we came here. And of that $800 million, $309 is payroll. It goes into the pockets of people in Idaho Falls, Pocatello, Blackfoot, Rexburg, and all of those towns around there. As I said, we're projecting essentially the same for this year. Of the $309 is spent on payroll, where does the rest of it go? A lot of it goes on procurement. $122 million in goods and services with Idaho businesses, large and small. As you can see at the bottom left, we have the actual employee numbers. At the end of last year, we finished just short of 4,000. And the pie chart shows you the different business areas we work in. Energy and environment is the smallest of the three, national and homeland security is the second largest, and nuclear energy and other related issues, nuclear issues is the largest. And the SMC, the blue section at the bottom, is where we make the tank armor. That's a specific manufacturing complex. The net of it all, about $800 million. Another way, of course, that money reappears in the economy, and this was discussed last year, is some of the other money goes into things like fringe benefits, medical, dental, optical, opticians, and most of that money is spent again in the region. So much more of that money stays in the region than would be apparent even from that simple analysis. This is the small business picture as a whole. As you can see, we estimated going into last year that we would do $260 million worth of small business. We actually did essentially $300 million, of which, as I said before, just over $120 million was spent in Idaho. There are services we can't get in Idaho, highly specialized services, special equipment. But you see, the goal set for us by DOE and ourselves was only $75 million, and we exceeded that handsomely. And the table on the right will show you what the goals were by subcategory within that and the actual dollar attainment. So small disadvantage was $23 million as opposed to $13 million, and so on down. And we exceeded in every case except HUBZone small business. Veteran-owned, for example, was $17 million as opposed to $5 or $6 million. So my eyes aren't good enough to tell me whether it's a five, yes, a five, and so on and so forth. So a lot of this money is not payroll money. It comes into the economy, it promotes and helps create small businesses in the region. This next one I'm not going to spend any time on, as it's not strictly an economic and budget issue, except to note that we, the contractors, and our staff do a lot of community giving, both of time on projects and actual money contributions. As you can see, the Pell Energy Alliance, the contractor I work for, contributed $700,000 in cash terms, and the employees over $300,000 to United Way. I have a feeling, you know, as times change over the next few years, these sorts of things will become more important rather than less important. But the community in Idaho Falls does a lot, and not just Idaho Falls. Part of our United Way giving goes down to the United Way organization that's based down in Pocatello, because a part of our giving comes from the staff who work in Pocatello, so we give proportionately to that region. Center for Advanced Energy Studies, this is where the state helped put the building together. The building is on the bottom right there, and JFAC visited a couple of months ago. I know I see some of the people who were there. Also, we have one-time state money in the last budget, I think it was $1.6 million, and we leveraged that to not only create more income, and as you'll see at the time of this view graph, K's had an operating revenue of $4.8 million of money brought in from other customers, which is a threefold return on that. But there's a second return, which in many ways I think is equally important. The way we use that money is to help fund joint appointments, and that money goes to universities for their part of it, and we, the lab, fund the other part of it, so it gets leveraged that way. So it makes the faculty cost cheaper to the university, and frankly, because of our presence, it makes the quality of the applicants and the appointees better too, which in turn benefits the students because they get better teaching, they get better research opportunities and more access to our facilities. So that money goes around several times, if you see what I mean. It's not just a monetary return. It's a return in the quality of the future quality of the workforce here. And you see in the first bullet, second sub-bullet, we've managed to assist the growth of Idaho students in engineering and science energy. And it quotes the nuclear number there, 5 to 125 in 3 years. And there are other programs like the ESTEC program at Idaho State, which is creating scientifically trained technicians to support the energy industry, which is really taking off as well. And these are some of the indirect impacts we have beyond simple dollars and cents. So when I look at the long-term picture beyond this year, as always with the federal government, it's clouded with uncertainty. We have relied on the last 4 years two main nuclear programs, the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership and the Next Generation Nuclear Plant. The first of those will certainly not increase and may diminish a little under the incoming administration. The second one, I'm very optimistic that the budget that will be passed in the next month or so will show a substantial increase for the Next Generation Nuclear Plant. So those two things wash out. Our national homeland security has grown tremendously over the last 3 years, and it's unrealistic for it to continue to grow on the same trajectory, so I expect that to flatten a little. On the other hand, I see our energy and environmental work, which has been really a two-year investment effort on our part, starting to produce more returns on that. So when I net it out, I expect the future to look largely the way it looks today, but with significant uncertainties about what the incoming administration will do, which is beyond my control. Although I do expect every indication is they're going to be pragmatist rather than idealistic about these things, and jobs and energy are going to be the issues, and with that, I think we're going to be just fine. I don't see a massive growth, but I don't see any significant downturn either. There's always risk. The future appropriations, the change in administration and competition, and of course, the political process. Senator Craig leaving the Senate does not help us. On the other hand, Congressman Simpson is rising up on the Republican ranks. He is ranking now on the Interior Committee, which gives him increased influence, and the balance there remains to be seen, but I'm not overly pessimistic. And of course, we have Senator Risch and Congressman Minnick coming in, both of them will be doing what they can to help Idaho, and as they spend time and get on the right committees and get influence, overall I think it'll be a positive outcome. This is, you'll hear us talk about the regional energy issue, and this, there's no economic state of Idaho budget relevance to this picture, except I think you need to see it. That picture on the right is a map of the energy resources in the region around here. The orange is oil sands, the coal basins are shown in blue, the oil shale to the south of us in green, and uranium. So that's Alberta, Saskatchewan, Montana, Wyoming, Utah, all of which sit aside a massive resource of energy. Now, it doesn't take you but a moment to look and see where the markets for energy are. They're in the west and the southwest. So however that energy is turned into a useful form, be it electricity, liquid fuels, whatever it may be, it's got to get to the market. And those transmission lines, in the general sense, not just electricity, have got to flow through Idaho or around Idaho. And we, as a technical organization, are working with every one of those governments, including the Canadian provinces, but also with the state of Idaho, Portland Lander's office, to work on energy resources, energy islands, thinking about how to link different forms of energy together to serve the future. And that is why I think that energy environment portion of our business will grow overall. Here now I'm going to talk for the other two contractors on the site, and I'll remind them that this is not my business, these are other companies. This one is CWI, the cleanup project. And remember, they are, by definition, by contract, supposed to put themselves out of business by 2012. They're cleaning up the legacy facilities, and we're meant to grow into what's created. So, and if you'll forgive me, I'll refer in detail to the notes, because this is their picture. Their work is completed, their headcount does go down. As of Christmas Eve, they had 1,511, and they're projecting headcount at the close of 2009 at 1,447, so down about 65. That is subject to change, though. As I said, the incoming administration is looking for job creation, and things like accelerated cleanup are job creation opportunities for working people. So it's perfectly possible that that might go up, or at least not go down. We don't know yet until the budgets from the new administration get in. And like us, they're operating on continuing resolution at 2008 funding levels, and they've got to figure out the 2009 budget. But with those caveats, they see basically a constant picture. The other main contractor is Advanced Mixed Waste Treatment Plant. 750 employees, 100 subcontractors, and an annual budget of $120 million in that case. I'm going to read because they provided me with this quote. Operations at the Advanced Mixed Waste Treatment Project, managed by Bechtel BWXT Idaho for DOE, are forecast to be the same as in 2008. No employee layoffs are forecast, and the project's budget is steady through DOE's fiscal year, enabling AMWTP to continue safely and compliantly shipping record amounts of radioactive transuranic waste out of Idaho. Apologize for reading, but I thought it was important, since I'm representing other people, to say exactly what they said. One of the questions you pose in your instructions for this meeting is, how is the mission of the lab going to change, and whether there is any uncertainty in the future? With the extension of our contract for another 7 years and potentially another 12 years, and we are owned by the DOE Office of Nuclear Energy, I can tell you with a certainty that our vision of the future remains the same. We'll be working in these three main business areas: nuclear energy and related subjects, national and homeland security, and energy and environment. And this is a slide we use to depict this, and if you start at the top left, you can follow that around. And in the top right, it emphasizes the cooperation part of our business and CAES and the importance of CAES. And the good news about that is that vision and how we'll try to operate that vision will remain changed for as long as we're there or until the federal government tells us to do something else. Of course, the bad news side of it is if the new administration decides that it does not want to invest in nuclear, then that will impact us, because we're not the sort of lab, and we don't want to be the sort of lab that changes to suit the circumstances. Our job is to be the best nuclear laboratory in the world, and we're on a path to do that. And But as I've said before, I think our best projection going forward is about level until we get clarity about what the new administration is doing. So that's pretty much the snapshot picture, and I've tried to keep it short, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. I would like to anticipate a question, though. I understand from looking at your material, you asked what can you do for us, and I really don't want to pass that opportunity up, so I'll answer it in advance. One of our biggest problems is Highway 20. As it goes out to the site, many of you know the weather in eastern Idaho in winter. We operate a bus fleet, and it's the largest mass transit in the state, for example. In January last year, we had a major accident where a pickup truck spun out, hit our bus. A number of people were seriously injured. Fortunately, nobody was killed. But that's not an unusual occurrence, so we have accidents out there. With Arriva and a big construction project out on US 20, again, Highway 20, we only see more problems. Anything that could be done, I mean, our number one priority for help from the state, apart from funding K's and all the rest of it, would be to try and help us with US 20. So that's my answer to that question, so I'll save somebody the trouble of asking. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Hill. Committee, any questions for Dr. Hill? Senator Giddey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Something on a national level that I have not followed, Doctor, is what the President-elect feels about nuclear energy. Can you give us any idea?
I'll be happy to, Mr. Chairman, Senator Getty. Senator Obama is a senator from Illinois. Illinois has a lot of nuclear power. He's familiar with nuclear power, and John Rowe, who is the chairman of Exelon, the operating utility in Illinois, has and probably still is an advisor. And I think his views are best characterized as pragmatic. He's not a wild enthusiast for nuclear power, and like many people, he would prefer there were other solutions, but he recognizes that right now 20% of our electricity comes from nuclear power, and they may need more of that if he's to meet his climate change goals. So what I expect is an emphasis on renewables for the future and pragmatism with respect to nuclear for today. I am speculating, of course, but that's about as best as I can determine it.
Thank you.
I see no further questions. Thank you very much for being here. We appreciate your presentation.
And a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
Next on our docket, Committee, is a presentation from Dan John from the Idaho State Tax Commission. We're going to have a little rubber hit the road here. This is where the next three presenters are actually going to have to fill in some blocks in our spreadsheet. So without any further ado, Mr. John, you have the floor.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. I am Dan John here representing the Tax Commission. Would like to point out to you once again this year, I've done this for the last 20 years, I am not an economist, and I like to make that clear before we get started. The numbers that you're going to look at today that are coming from the Tax Commission are based on the collections through the first half of the fiscal year. The memo you have says, then based on the judgment of the Tax Commission staff, that's shorthand for me. So don't blame anyone else for these numbers other than me. I was hoping to bring you cheery news this afternoon after watching part of your proceedings on the internet. The jury's out whether you'll be cheered up after you hear from me or not. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll jump right into to the numbers. The first page you have is the fiscal year to date, and I would be remiss if I didn't point out this is July through December collections. It's actually June through November business activity. There's always that lag in the collection, so this does not reflect the majority of the Christmas season in the sales tax numbers, which it never does, but I just want to point that out. And December is preliminary numbers. These have not been released yet, so I have privy to some numbers that the other presenters have not as yet seen. Going going into this, individual income tax currently is $41 million behind what it was this time last year, or about 6.7%. This is a combination of withholding and also payments. I did look at the payments which were made in December, which can be a little misleading because of mail times and things, but the payments that people make so they can deduct their income tax on their federal return, that's what a lot of those are, were down considerably from last year. So you may have, that may be an indication that self-employed individuals, people who don't have a lot of withholding, maybe aren't going to be paying us as much tax in the October or the April timeframes of the upcoming year. Corporate tax is really running along. It's about 9.3% lower than it was at this time last year. I'm going to go out on a limb, and that's going to weaken some between now and the end of the fiscal year and when I get to the next page. Sales tax, this is the one that people are very anxiously watching. This is down about $51 million, or 8.4%. Keep in mind, this is June through November activity. Black Friday was very late this year, so I don't know if that would have contributed at all to the poor performance of the sales tax in the December collections. It was relatively weak. The next ones are the sin taxes, which all run fairly steady along, other than things such as the kilowatt hour tax and the mine license. They're bouncing around a little bit. Mine license is way off. That's an indicator of what silver and gold are doing and the cost of production. Kilowatt hour is up by quite a bit. If you've looked out in the mountains recently, you've seen a lot of snow. The kilowatt hour tax is really a function of the water supply, since kilowatt hour tax comes from electricity by water power. Cigarette tax on here is up. I will point out the cigarette tax that goes to the general fund is purely a function of appropriation. That is the money that is appropriated every year to go to pay the bonds. I believe they're school bonds that the state subsidizes. So that is not necessarily an indication of what's going on. All of the money other than appropriated amount goes to other accounts, to dedicated accounts. So that number on the cigarette tax is really whatever you want it to be, up to the slightly less than $40 million that it generates. But it is running ahead right now just because the forecast is appropriations going to be higher for that amount. Unclaimed property is running higher. I can't explain that. It seems to be, or it's running lower. Last year was very, very high. It's off by 34%. It's still higher than you would suspect at this point in time. One of the things I failed to point out to you is I do not forecast the things we don't collect. So the insurance premiums tax, all of the things such as that, I do not forecast. So I believe that Ray will plug those numbers in into the forecast for me. I think they're fairly straightforward. Moving to the 09 estimates, this is where we get into what we think is really going to happen. I would expect individual income tax to stay weak, to be off about 7.4% for a general fund amount of $1.325 billion for the upcoming year. Corporate tax, I think, is going to weaken more than it has already. I think it'll come in at about $160 million for fiscal 09. And sales tax, I'm holding at about the 8.4%. down than it was through December. Sales tax, unless something really changes, has a tendency to track pretty true through the year what the percentage is after you get into it. So, but it will still be down 8.4%, or a little less than $100 million from what it was last year going in. Like I say, the sin taxes and the product taxes don't fluctuate much, but for the overall for the year, for the dollars collected by the commission, a little less than $2.6 billion, which is down $233 million from what we took in fiscal 08, or 8.4% in total that we will be off from fiscal year 08 in our estimation. Fiscal year 10, getting harder to predict as we get out further. My feeling is individual will rebound a little bit, about 1.5%. That's essentially flat. My estimation would be $1.345 billion is about what that's going to be. I think corporate will weaken significantly going into fiscal year 10. That's really calendar year, and the fiscal year is beginning in 09 business activity for the corporations. I expect it to be off about 18.8%. The sales tax, I think, will flatten out, be down slightly, but come in just about 1% lower than for fiscal 09. And once again, the other taxes just stay within their nice little comfort range. There is a pretty good jump in the cigarette tax, but that is the estimate that's going to be appropriated to pay those bonds, or the bond interest. And you'll notice the unclaimed properties back to about $2.5 million. It's not a tax, but we collect it. That is a normal amount. That's about what it runs year over year. We had a little bit of a spike last year and the year before. The tobacco tax is running high. It's been running high for a couple of years. Can't explain it other than there was a law change that makes it so there is a use tax component, meaning if you're buying your fine cigars over the internet, we can go out and do enforcement and collect the tobacco tax we had never been able to do before. And last but not least, Mr. Chairman, is 2011. The numbers that I know everyone is very confident when they're putting these out that they're going to happen. This is going to be the year that everyone really thinks is going to be when the recovery starts, with fiscal year versus the calendar years. I'm projecting sales tax and income tax to be up 4%, corporate to be up 5%, and everything else just to about run their normal course. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to try and respond to any questions.
Thank you very much, Dan. Committee, questions for Mr. John? Senator Baer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dan, thank you for your presentation. I wondered if you could point out for me or explain to me what evidences you have that in 2010 the downturn's not going to continue down.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Baer, what I know is what I read in the newspapers, the same as you. What I'm hearing is most economists are saying that the worst will be over at the end of 2009, which takes in half of fiscal 10, and that's the reason I think it's going to mitigate. The things I've read are implying that the recession will have bottomed out and will be starting back up by the end of calendar year 09 and into calendar year 2010.
Senator Biddy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. John, have we successfully recovered tax from internet sales of cigars?
Mr. Chairman, the fear factor enters into this, and we have spread the word. There are signs up in many of the finer establishments around the state that sell other tobacco products, pointing out the fact that there is now a use tax on these products. And no, I would not tell you we've collected it all.
Thank you.
Senator Billion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Dan, I believe you referred to the December sales tax figures. And did you add anything in for that? And can you just delineate a little bit on that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Billion, I did not add anything in, nor did I subtract anything presupposing that the December sales activity that's reported in January would be worse than it had been coming in prior to that. I listened to Ms. Eaton this morning talking about how retailers were saying that their December, their Christmas sales were not as bad as they had predicted, and it actually gave me a little bit of I was a little more positive after hearing that than when I first put these numbers together.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. John. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Committee, our next presentation will be by Raymond Morrison, President of Associated Taxpayers of Idaho. welcome to the committee meeting. Appreciate it. Look forward to your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think while that's being handed out, I just explain a little bit about what the information you're getting. I've been doing this for 20 years now, and this year I think is the most challenging of those 20. The first and last page of what you're getting are the key things, and then everything that's in between is documentation and a little explanation of the methodology I use to come up with these numbers. If you look at the first page, you'll see I've got kind of a history there of the revenue projections over the years, and then I've just shown my overall revenue forecast for 2009, 10, and 11. And I guess I would just point out that when I do these forecasts, again, like Mr. John said, I'm not an economist, but I have, and I don't use any simulation model with computers or anything. I just analyze the monthly data that I see. I also look at how things are tracking with what BFM has done in their adjusted forecast from August. And then I do a lot of reading, and I'd like to just cover some of the reading I do that I think helps do some of the out years. The first thing I guess I'd point out is when we originally projected revenues last year for 2009, it was over $3 billion, if you recall. And we've done quite a bit of adjustment since then, but you can see my 2009 number is basically about almost 11% less than that original projection, and it's still about 3% less than what is currently being projected at the $2,766,000,000. The economic forecasters do not expect the economy to recover before the last part of calendar year 2009, and many do not expect it to rebound until into 2010, which I think, as Mr. John pointed out, that does impact a lot of 2010 revenues, and I will be covering in the next few pages some of what I found really that follows along with what you heard him say. If you go to the next page there, page items 1 and 2, what I've covered there on page 2 is national and global economy, and I just hit some of the highlights from some of these articles that I've been following. The current recession is expected to last at least into the second half of 2009. The second article from December 24th, a deepening recession and tight credit conditions are compounding problems in the housing market, suggesting that declines in home prices may continue well into 2009. If you go down to the December 11 article, there's a couple of surveys that I wanted to highlight. They do show widespread pessimism among executives about the economy and their company's prospects in 2009, with many planning to slash spending and employment in coming months. Nearly 60% of the chief financial officers said they don't expect the U.S. economy to recover before the fourth quarter of 2009, and about 40% don't expect a rebound before 2010. But anyway, that kind of gives you the sense of what I was picking up from that article. And the university, Duke University, is actually the ones who did this survey. The professor there said that the optimism is the lowest they've seen since beginning this survey 12 years ago. In another survey, this was more from human resources for professionals, which represented more than 750 companies, and they expect their firms, whatever business performance means, they didn't define that, to decline in 2009. But I thought that was important to point and highlight some of that. The next article was from a January 4th, last weekend. Manufacturing activity around the world, if you go to page 3 right at the top, around the world fell sharply in December, suggesting that the U.S. recession will extend well into 2009, if not longer, and that unemployment will rise globally. The next part of this, item number 2 there on page 3, gets a little closer into statewide and still some national. But economists in the very first article, this is from the Statesman, economists say employment will rebound eventually, but it could take a year or more, and Idaho could see a jobless rate nudging 9% before the recession is over. And I did not hear what the Department of Labor had to say, if that's close to what they said in their presentation to you. The next part there, just a retailer's report from a December, late December article in the Idaho Statesman. A weak economy and strong winter storms brought total retail sales down between 5.5 and 8% from a year ago, and that's according to preliminary data from what's called Sending Pulse. The next part there under Idaho Business Review, I thought it would be good to point out Dr. John Mitchell with U.S. Bancorp was here in Boise in December, and the group he talked to, I think the keys he pointed out to economic recovery include absorbing the inventory of housing, repairing corporate and personal bank balance sheets, thawing the credit market, and restoring confidence. The economy must address declines in personal wealth, the challenges of the aging population, and job growth. Let's go to the next page, the fourth item there. This gets more into the regional and Idaho from Marple's Business Newsletter out of Seattle. And I think a couple of things I'd point out that I did pick up from some of the reading there. A downtown trend looks to last far longer and be more severe than the recessions of 90 to 91 and 2001 that they say were mostly about 8 months in length in each of those. The Pacific Northwest has come through a long period where the regional economy consistently outran forecasts. Don't be surprised if things go the other way for a time. It could be 2012 or later before we get back to the cyclical highs in employment. And then if you go to the last, events or reference that I'm showing here is from an Economic Outlook Forum that was held in November here in Boise with the Chamber of Commerce. They had a futurist there, Glenn Heinstra, who made predictions for the next 2 to 5 years, and those included fiscal stimulus that we're pretty familiar with and I know is being discussed even more now to get the economy moving, and adjusting to a consumer economy where people are very likely to now save more, spend less, and take on less debt. And then we also, at that meeting, heard from Gerald Fenner, who talked about the economic conditions and the risk factor in the housing market because of those. But he did also report that Idaho received almost $20 million to help buyers purchase foreclosed properties that are currently on the market. And then if you go to the final page of some of this reading and research that I followed, you've heard from John Church, so I'm not going to cover that. But if you go to the very last part there, this is by Paul Hiller with the Boise Valley Economic Partnership. It is a positive note of all the information I'm summarizing here. Despite the economic downturn, more companies are looking at the Treasure Valley as a region to relocate or expand than ever before. But I think this bright report, too, may see delays in potential job expansion and relocation decisions. If you go to the next page, what I did here, each year I cover a little more detail what's been going on with property values around the state, and I thought this would be helpful again to show you what the results were for this year. But if you look at the what I've done here, I take the 10 largest counties in population, and then I add 4 counties that have had a lot of assessed value change, a change in the property values that have increased the most. And by doing that, I cover basically 14 counties, or almost a third of the counties, about 44 counties. But when you look at the subtotal, which I'd like you to focus on, you can see those 14, they're about 77% of the population. The assessed value in 2008, there's 74% of that assessed value. Last year's report, when I did that, there were 14 counties. It wasn't exactly this 14 because it changes every year a little bit, but they were 83% of the total assessed value. This year, of the change, of the increase in assessed value from last year, we're showing of those 14 counties, 3.9 billion of the change that was almost 5.5 billion statewide came from those 14 counties. That was 71% of the value change. Last year, 14 counties had 85.85% of the value change, and the value change was over 17 billion last year. So it gives you a feel to what's going on there. If you go to the bottom of this, a little more detail on just generally across the state, what's going on there with some categories of property. When you look at, I'll just go down the ones with increases, urban, rural, non-owner occupied, not homeowners, the non-owner occupied residential, of our 4.4% increase in assessed value statewide, they increased 8%. The urban, rural, commercial, industrial category increased 8.3%. Urban, rural, commercial, and industrial increased 3.4%, and agriculture, I'm sorry, 8.3%. Agriculture is the next one I meant to go to, was 3.4%, timber 5.7%, and operating or the utility properties 3.8%. We did have a couple categories that actually reduced in value from the year before. That included both the urban, rural, the owner-occupied residential, the homes, by about 0.5%, and then mining was 7.8%. So that gives you a little feel for some of the types of property as well as where the properties are. You go to the next page. If you'd like to see this by county instead of just those 14 that I covered, you can see the changes in market value by county. This is in descending order. And you can see from the largest changes down to the smallest, we did have four counties that actually had a reduction in their taxable value for this year. Then you go to the next page, if you'd like to see this in a little differently. This covers the entire state for several years, from 83 to 2008. And you can see there we had some pretty major growth that started occurring in 1989 in our property values, went up to about 1997, then it sort of sustained for a while. Then it started growing again from 2002 to 2007, and you can see those big numbers, the 14, the 19, 16% increases in 3 years in a row there, compared to that 4.4% for this year. So a big change. The next page, all that I'll just very briefly, all that I do, I use a couple methods. One is just sort of what I call my modified straight line method to do forecasting. It just gives me a feel. I did not use method one here at all for what I was doing this year, but it gives me a feel of things kind of occurred the way they had in previous years. What would we be looking at a forecast for 2009? Actually, what I used is a second method, and again, as I mentioned, I follow BFM's August estimates, the actual monthly trends that have been going on, and then the research that we just covered. Once I come up with 2009, then I go forward mostly based on that the reading material. And then I'll get you to the last page, which I think is the key thing you're looking for in this committee. This covers the several years here, 2003, and I did go all the way out to 2011, as Ray had asked that we do. But this will include my 2009, 2010, and 2011 forecasts that were on page one, but this gives you a little more of the detail by the different tax types. And I guess I'll just stop right there, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that presentation. Representative Laird, first question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Andy, both you and the Tax Commission both forecast substantial increase in the product taxes between 2009 and 2010. What drives that?
Mr. Chairman, what's Representative Lake, what's going on there is primarily the cigarette tax for the bond levy equalization. It was about $6.5 million was the actual number in 2008, and that's more of a, I guess I'd call it an appropriation. It was $7.5 million. This year, it's estimated to be $15.3 million, and all I'm doing is just following what is expected to be appropriated for that amount. So that's why it jumped up so much.
So follow up on that then. That just indicates you're going from the dedicated fund that had been in going over to general fund.
Yes.
Thank you.
The cigarette tax, yes.
Thank you. Representative Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Randy, on your table that talks about the county assessed property values, I believe it's page 6. Those numbers are measured between 12/31/07 and 12/31/08, and that's the assessed value at that time. Do you have any indication of what the assessed values have just been done last week and where we might be? Can you take a guess of speculation of property values?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roberts, I have not talked to any assessors about that. I was thinking about it the other day by walking around the neighborhood and going, it's going to be very interesting to see what that shows up to be here. I really have not asked and tried to get any indication, but my guess is it's going to be lower, maybe not even the 4.4% growth that we have this year.
Any further questions, committee? Thank you very much for being here. Thank you for your presentation. Committee, next we have a presentation from Dr. Scott Vincent of ISU, and along with him we should have Dr. Stephen Cook from U of I and Dr. Don Holly from VSU. Welcome, gentlemen, and Dr. Vincent, if you'd please take the mic, and we look forward to your presentation.
Hello, I'm Scott Benson. I'm just here to refer to Steve Cook, who's making our presentation this year. Although Dr. Holly, myself, and I are all here to respond to questions after Dr. Cook finishes his presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, and thank you for this opportunity to address the committee. These are hard times, and it was my luck of the draw to be the presenter this year. I've been on this university assessment committee 4 years, and my colleagues are very anxious and happy for me to make the presentation this year. My name is Steve Cook. I'm on faculty at the University of Idaho in the Department of Agricultural Economics, and I work broadly speaking in the area of economic development and public finance. The first part of our presentation is 25 slides long. The first dozen slides approximately address the general questions that were asked in the packet. You have been listening to dozens of presentations that address the general economic situation in the nation and in Idaho in particular, and I don't want to take the committee's time to replow that ground. With one possible note that you do ask us to make policy recommendations in number 5 to promote economic growth and higher wages. And I'm using that as a wedge to make some suggestions at the end of the presentation. These are for your edification, these first dozen slides or so. And I'll just walk through them slowly. I think this is an important one to give you an overview of employment by sector and how that's changed. And you may want to keep that in consideration. One note here I would point out is that government's employment is a large proportion of total employment in the state, and it's one that is actually doing fairly well. So decisions that state government makes about budget cuts would affect that sector. This is relative unemployment rates compared to our neighbors. Residential construction and non-residential construction and the change in that. One point I would make here, this is the relative default rate and foreclosure rate by mortgage category, and you'll see that the subprime adjustable rate mortgage category represents the greatest past due and foreclosure rates in the state. I think that's noteworthy. This is notes on a lecture that Professor Jeffrey Frankel made to members of Congress. He's a Harvard professor, and they do an orientation, and I really liked his analysis of the current economic situation. This is laid out for your benefit. these are the specific questions that you asked us to address, and in particular, we'll be addressing question number one, what are your estimates of state general fund revenue for 09, 10, and 11, and what evidence do you have to support these estimates? And also, number four, I'd like to address that one a little bit. To what extent are the state revenues affected by the activity of the stock market? So those two in particular, not two and three. Okay, this, Mike Ferguson gave you a presentation at the opening of this committee meeting about using just this data, and this is a nice summary, it seems to me, of what the economic activity of Idaho has been relative to the nation. This is a nice presentation of what has happened to housing prices, both by, for the state as a whole and by the, sort of the three major regions, the north, the southeast, and the southwest. You can see we've had a considerable housing bubble. This is where I wanted to talk about the effect of the stock market on general fund revenue. Although changes in capital gains are not, strictly speaking, a source of personal income because it's a change in a stock value rather than a flow. So when you get a stock appreciation and you sell it, you realize a capital gain, and that capital gain shows up on your federal income tax. So it, it shows up in our income tax revenue, but it's not wage and pay category. And you can see from this that there's a considerable amount of fluctuation in capital gains that Idahoans are reporting. This is from the IRS. And this would be invaluable information for us to have if, to project the general fund revenue. The problem is the IRS doesn't release this in a timely fashion. So looking backwards, we sort of know what happened to us, but going forward, we're not able to anticipate it. And what this shows is sort of what I call a sickle relationship to capital gains reporting on Idahoans' income taxes, with a run-up between 97 to 01, followed by a crash. I assume that's associated with the tech bubble, and then a subsequent run-up again with the recovery. Now, I keep note of that shape because in the next slide, if we look at the relationship between the growth in personal income, which are the little empty circles, and the growth in general fund revenue, this is in real per capita terms, they track very, very closely together. And it's this relationship that I'm going to be using in subsequent forecasts to suggest what I think is going to happen to revenue in the state of Idaho. And if you'll notice from about 98, if you connected the red dots from 98 to 2006, it maps out that little inverted sickle. And I would suggest that it's those capital gains that are fluctuating around in the personal income of Idahoans that is causing that change in general fund revenue for the state as a whole. Okay, very close. I mean, the bottom line of this chart is, if I know what's going on with personal income, real per capita, that's after adjusted for inflation and adjusted for population, I think I have a pretty good understanding of what's going to happen to general fund revenue, real per capita. Okay, the three of us entered the room yesterday and came out with four different opinions. This is a summary of those opinions right here in detail for each category. This is more detail than I care to address, and I'm not an expert in all the individual categories by a long shot, but I wanted you to have that in your packet, just sort of for your information. I would consider this a logging, and what I want to do is forestry, and so I'll move on to my forestry chart, where I summarize this in many fewer rows. But I've added a few. I've added two particular rows. One is the general fund revenue trend and the general fund revenue cycle. And the sum of those two rows add to what I'm calling general fund revenue. And I think in hard times, it's easy to lose orientation. And I think what is helpful with this chart is that the general fund revenue trend gives you a sense of what would be the historic pattern of general fund revenue receipts if we were not going through a recession. And then our bottom line is our best guess, primarily based on Global Insight projections as to what's actually going to be in the till at the end of this fiscal year. And so the difference between what the trend would be and what the actual revenues would be is going to be the shortfall, presumably, between these two patterns. And that, to me, is a signal of, one, when to use the rainy day funds and to what extent. That's sort of how I would look at it if I were a legislator. And at the very bottom, we have our percentage change in growth in general fund revenue over those 15 years. Okay, this is by source, and this is how you receive the revenue. These are the major tax sources, primarily income and sales tax. How I think of it is by cause. And what I think causes revenue is the tax capacity of the state is related to the income of Idahoans. And as that income expands, the tax capacity expands. And that tax capacity appears in the row I'm calling PR income slash capita, which is real personal income per capita. That's where the tax base, you might say, of the state of Idaho increases or decreases. The other two rows above it are CPI, which is inflation, and population. General fund revenue will increase just because the value of the dollar decreases, and so you bring in more. And so it's more of a measurement problem than anything. Economics is a little bit of an unusual discipline in the sense that our ruler changes year to year because the dollar's value changes with inflation, and we have to adjust for it. And so that row is adjusting for inflation. And then the population of the state of Idaho is changing year to year, so you can bring in more money because more people are in the state subsequently than there were initially. So those are two, I don't want to call them false indicators, but they're two complicating indicators so that you can have revenues increasing because of the inflation and population, but actually having your per capita personal income go down. So you can get sort of a mixed signal. It looks like income is going up when, in fact, real per capita income is going down after you've adjusted for inflation and population. What I have done, and where I'm going with this, is to suggest to you, since each one of you has to come up with an estimate of what the revenue is going to be, I'm giving you a little worksheet rule of thumb, I call it, to how to figure it. And essentially what you would do is to take the previous year's general fund revenue and then multiply it by the sum of the change in population, inflation, and real per capita income. And that would give you a rough estimate of what the next year's revenue is going to be. And that's possible because of that very, very close relationship between general fund revenue and real per capita personal income. And we've gone through this exercise to do this chart. And in fact, if I'm not mistaken, I actually give you a little worksheet to show you that this really does work, to prove to myself, maybe. What I've done here is I've said the growth in general fund revenue is equal to the sum of the growth in the sales tax rate, but you haven't changed that, so that's zero. The change in the growth in the consumer price index, which is projected in FY10 to be about 2%, the change in the growth of population, state of Idaho's population is growing about 1.6%, and then the change in the growth of real per capita income, and this is the key number. How much is real per capita income growing? And we made a guess, hopefully an educated guess, that real per capita income in the state is going to grow by 0.5% in the next fiscal year. We add those together and multiply by the 09 base, and we get $2,790,000,000. So that's how I did it anyway. That's one way to think about it. Okay, so to put into words what equation one is saying is that the growth in fiscal year FY10 general fund revenue equals the sum of the growth in the sales tax rate effect, but you haven't been changing that, so that's zero, the inflation rate, the population rate, and then the product of the growth of real personal income times a little multiplier. You actually get a little more general fund revenue from real per capita income. It's more than 1-to-1. It's 1.1-to-1. It's a little multiplier effect in there. Okay, now that's how you find the rate. How do you know what the base is? I use the previous year's base, but what if you're at the peak or the trough of a business cycle? Then you can give yourself false positives or false negatives by being sort of very high or very low. So what I did is I know what the general fund revenue is going back to 1970. So I have 39 years worth of data. And what I did is I took all of those general fund revenues and I corrected them for the difference in population, inflation, sales tax rate, and personal income. And then I multiplied it by my projected rate. And what I got was a frequency distribution using those bases of what the next year's general fund revenue would be. And what this says is the mean would be about $3 billion. So that, in trying times, that sort of gives you a trend so that you know that over time, the state, when it's expanded, has been above that. When it's contracted, it's been below that. But on average, it's been in between, and it's been that in between for FY10 would be about $3 billion. So you have now, I would argue, something to compare your actual against, because the actual is going to be low. So how low is it relative to what? Well, relative to about $3 billion based on 39 years of data. And then if we play this game retrospectively, we will see that we will map out the little trend line, which is the dashed line, and then compare it to what we actually collected over that time period. And you'll see the little black dots sort of bouncing around the trend line, sometimes above, sometimes below. And then, just to make this even more interesting, I put Mike's projections 18 months out to see how close he came. I have a tremendous amount of respect for Mike's ability. Don't get me wrong. But it's very, very hard to track actual projections because a large part of it is random. It's just, you could flip a coin and almost be lucky to do it. It's much easier, I think, to figure out what the long run trend is, and that's what I tried to do here. And I think this, to me, it's reassuring to know where we are in the process. And trend line, I think, does that. And we can see now that our revenues are coming in. The bars, by the way, are 10% below and above the trend line. So, and that those bars would give you a sense of, say, how big the rainy day fund should be. Because if the dot is never off the bar, then if you have a rainy day fund of about 10%, you're always going to have essentially more or less enough to cover it. And if you make a mistake, this is what happens. You have holdbacks. And it seems to me this is when it's, I would argue, it's fun to be a politician because people, it's always nice to give people things, but when you have to take it back, that's when it's no fun. Well, you've had to do that relatively consistently through time, essentially every time there's a recession and sometimes when there isn't. And if we could, well, I'll wait for the policy recommendations on what I think might happen. Here's some conclusions. I think in FY09 that there will be a decrease in general fund revenue of about 8% to $2,675,000,000, which is about $10 million lower than the governor's current estimate. So that would leave about a $255 million difference between the trend and what we will actually receive. Almost all of the rainy day fund, as I understand it. The general fund revenue in FY10 will increase 4.3 to $2,790,000,000. And that will leave about a $210 million difference between the trend and what you'll actually collect. And then in FY11, it gets harder and harder, obviously, as you go out further. We are guessing, we're hoping for a recovery in that fiscal year. So we're suggesting that you're going to have about an 8.8% increase in general fund revenue. That will bring you up to $3,035,000,000. But that will still leave you with a $140 million difference between what you would be on trend versus what you're actually going to receive. So the upshot of this, we are recommending that the legislator use the rainy day funds roughly proportionally to the revenue gap in the relative to the trend, which will work out, roughly speaking, 40% in FY09, 35% in FY10, and 25% in FY11. Now, admittedly, that's, you use it all up, because that adds to 100, but that's over 3 years. Recessions aren't supposed to last 3 years. Recessions aren't supposed to last 6 months, and we're projecting 2 years of a recession in this one and 3 years of using a rainy day fund. So I'd like to think that we're being realistic to suggest this kind of allocation. Beyond that, our suggestions are relative to number four in your general, this is where we're using some license here, relative to economic growth, try to maintain a wide and stable tax base. Don't give in to the efforts on parts of special interests to have specialized tax breaks for them. It's important to keep a broad and stable tax base, I would argue. And in particular, for the sales tax base, it would be very helpful to extend it to services, because now it's on goods. Most of our economy is services. You're penalizing goods for the benefit of services in a primarily service economy, and it's sort of treating equals unequally. And I'd say that it's not only unfair, but good tax policy, I think, would suggest that they should be more broad-based than that. Consider a temporary sales tax rate increase to help cover the gap. Consider a temporary income tax surcharge. I personally would prefer D over C, because you would be taxing people with jobs, whereas in C you would be taxing everyone, whether they're employed or not. I would say continually fully fund K-12 and higher ed. We fully recognize this is completely self-serving as university professors, but keep in mind, when you're trying to keep real per capita income increasing, you need a productive and effective labor force, and that comes through education, I would argue. And this is a long-term objective. In a short-run crisis, we need to keep the long-term in view as well. And finally, to regulate the subprime adjustable rate mortgages to the extent the state government has control over that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Cook. Committee, do we have any questions? Senator Fulcher.
Thank you, Chairman. I just want to go on record by saying, in terms of the forecast, that's exactly what I intend to do for my homework assignment. Chairman, that was a joke.
Very, very dry, Senator. Strangely appropriate for the committee. Committee, any inquiries? Representative McGinn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And is it Dr. Cook?
It is.
Thank you. Your presentation, I noticed on your calculation for individual income tax, could you discuss the issue of capital gains, which my husband reminded me of that, that this year is going to be particularly excessive losses for certain individuals on their income tax, and I don't really know how much detail we got on that from the tax commission, but is your higher reduction rate, does that kind of reflect that capital gains aspect?
Dr. Cook.
Mr. Chairman, representative, it reflects it to the extent that real per capita income reflects it, and it's embedded in it. We haven't broken out capital gains per se. What I was trying to say in my remarks is that I think we know what's causing personal income to fluctuate. Actually, I should say general fund revenue to fluctuate relative to personal income, and that it's capital gains. But we don't know it beforehand. So any assumptions that we make about personal income, we need to keep in mind whether capital gains is going to be high or low. That's the way we would capture it. We're using Global Insights forecasts. Whether they've included it or not, I don't know. And that's why I wanted to be so transparent about how I calculated it, because I think it's very important for you to think, give it your best guess as to what you think personal income is going to be relative to capital gains or capital losses. I mean, this would be a time to take a capital loss, which will bring personal general fund revenue through the income tax down even more, as I understand the tax code.
Representative Killen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm kind of a math one. I'm looking at slide page 18, where you had the formula.
Yes.
And on the right-hand side, you have defined what the various variables mean, but I think those variables don't appear in the math on the left. So
Dr. Cook?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kellen. Those variables appear in column under FY10 in particular. The zero for sales tax is here. The CPI is here. The population is here. Now, we didn't include this. We included the minus 1.2% increase for the trend, but we included, we were optimistic. We were saying that for the actual,
we're going to be coming into a recovery, and there's going to be some virtuous cycle things that happen when a business cycle moves in the uptick. So we are projecting a 0.5% real per capita increase in income. If we didn't make the trend real per capita income different from the actual, then the actual would never catch up to the trend. That's a sticky mathematical and political point, for that matter.
Thank you. I have a quick question for you, Dr. Cook. And, you know, you kind of brought this on. In regards to three of the policy proposals that had further tax burden implications, so I'd always be them employed, be them unemployed, be them one who maybe has taken a recent reduction in salary to maintain a job. Can you speak to the other side of that coin in regards to that burden in these economic times to average Idahoan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's an excellent question, because we know from economic theory the last thing you should do in a recession is increase taxes. And the national government can get away with that by deficit spending. So they run up a deficit in the bad times and pay it off in the good times. State governments do not have that luxury. Fortunately, and to your credit, the state of Idaho has done everything right in setting aside a very substantial rainy day fund. In my view, you are given A for that foresight. And thank God for it, because now you need it. And so the way to not have to do those is to use the rainy day fund now. That's my... But to the extent that you need to maintain services, then these are painful, they're just painful choices at that time. That's all I can say.
And from your projections, you would calculate in rough terms that the rainy day revenues need to last at least 2 years.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking 3 years.
3 years. Thank you very much.
Very well.
Any further questions, committee? Seeing none, did you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not entirely certain that Dr. Cook can answer it, but I'm wondering if you know someone who can.
Well,
I can give it a try, too.
Give it a try, Senator.
Okay. Dr. Cook, one of the things that we are going to have to measure or guess at this year is the number of people who are likely to run out their savings and their resources. First of all, they're the category of those who are already jobless and how long they're... unemployment benefits will last. The second is those who are about to lose jobs. And then the reason we need to know this is because the timing of when people qualify for public assistance. And so to some extent, our estimation of where it's wise to spend, where we need to be ready to provide more services is kind of based on this. And do you know of anybody who's done an analysis that really looks at kind of like quintile or at least some sort of economic strata, where the job losses are and what income areas and how long people have been jobless in those areas and that sort of thing?
Dr. Cook.
Mr. Chairman, Senator LaFever, the excellent question, and no, I do not know. And I do not know myself, and I don't know anyone who's looked at it. But I'd be certain. Sorry.
Senator?
Mr. Chairman, maybe I have a graduate student or something from like that.
Well, thank you very much for being here, and thank you for your presentation today. Committee, we will wrap up now with more comprehensive instruction from Mr. Houston in regards to our homework assignment. Mr. Houston.
what I've given you here, you're still in the universities, the tax commission, the associated taxpayers. I did use the detail on the universities, so you'll see there, plus or minus $1 million or so from some of their slides. I used their detail slide. But I've also emailed you this electronically in Excel, so you can fill your numbers in that committee projection column. It'll calculate the percentages for you. If you want to work backwards, you can do some goal seeking and some of those kinds of tools are in the spreadsheet. If not, you can return this to me hard copy. Just write your numbers or your percentages on there, and I'll make sure that we get those worked into our tallies. The 2011 figures, I guess I'll visit with you, Mr. Chairman, about how you'd like to see that reported.
Thank you, Ray. And again, online information for historical data prior to 2009.
Mr. Chairman, you have that in your packet. There is, I'm not sure what the page is.
Okay, great. Yeah,
several of the presenters have also included it, but there's in your packet, there's pages 16 and 17. There's a detailed history, a 10-year history of the actual collections by tax source.
Okay, so that's just hard copy. That's not part of an online spreadsheet.
Mr. Chairman, it's not part of the spreadsheet, but it's available also through the Internet, the hard copy. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Any questions for Mr. Houston? Representative McGinn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ray, on the email that you sent to us that has the spreadsheet, I'm trying to type numbers in, and I'm assuming the reason why it won't go in is because it's protected. But if I hit follow your instructions, it says choose tools and then protect an unprotected sheet. I don't have that option under tools.
I'll have to visit with you here right after this. Make sure we got everybody working.
Okay. That sounds good, Ray.
Resend.
Okay, Senator Folsom.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to mention, since we got those new PCs, it's got the new operating system skin, and so it's in there, but it's not going to be probably the same thing as Ray's looking at, so we'll just have to figure out what that is.
Okay, good point. Maybe we can get a little technical assistance with that, Ray. Pro Tem. Mr. Chairman and Ray, I know in years past sometimes we've submitted that projection anonymously. In the last few years we've attached our name to it. Which way are we going to go this year?
Pro Tem, as I understand in meeting with the co-chair, we were going to template last year's format. I'm not sure how that could possibly be altered at this particular time. I guess it would probably be self-evident if one of you chose to be anonymous.
Mr. Chairman, I think that was the right answer.
Well, thank you very much, committee. I appreciate all the hard work and to all our presenters. I extend another expression of gratitude. Got a little work ahead of us, and committee members, due diligence, and we look forward to the governor's presentation next Monday. And with that, the committee is adjourned.